Chuck Coffey and Marcia Ripp for National Council of Jewish Women interviewing High Richmond, Thursday, July 30th, 1986. We're going to clean up a few loose ends today, and one of them is that we never found out whether your sisters went on to college or what schooling they had.
Well, my sisters, two of whom were older than I and one slightly younger, didn't go to college. They graduated from high school, but the family was quite poor, and that together with the fact that the European tradition of men first for advanced education and women first for marriage and children combined so that they went right from high school to whatever jobs they could get. Their jobs were clerical.
Okay, you want to speak about your work as a labor mediator?
Well, this is my most recent job, paralleling my teaching. In 1974, at which time I was 56, I had an opportunity for early retirement on a special program with the government. And this provided for a reduced immediate pension. I took it because I had a few job offers at the time. The local community college wanted me to come with them as director of employee relations because they had just been unionized and I had had experience on both sides as far as public employee unions were concerned. I also had an opportunity to go with a few school boards in the same capacity. I also had this opportunity to be a labor mediator, which satisfied me most because the other jobs, one was to be a protagonist in that instance on the side of management. It wasn't that I was against it, but I preferred having the medium role, and that is getting the two sides together. I always like the term machen shalom, making peace. And in a sense, that's what a mediator does. So that it's a third-party role, which is quite satisfying because you're reducing conflict, tension. You're also reducing severe inconvenience for the government. It was also challenging because public employee unionization, which is the special area that I handle, is a comparatively new thing. It's now 15 years old. And there's a great lack of sophistication, so that I was able to use my background to help the parties in working out solutions, getting them away from their individual pride of authorship, respecting demands and counter-demands, and making suggestions to solve their problems rather than their positions. The overall lifetime experience I've had has allowed me to also bring an atmosphere of calm to the sessions. These people are very good at whatever they do, and they do role-playing when it comes to bargaining, and very often they're very inept at it. So one can work with the two sides and still be a neutral. This has been very satisfying.
Okay, you mentioned that your daughter worked with the Neuberters. Could you spell their name?
No, I don't think I said she lives and works in Portland, Oregon, and I admire the state because it elected the Neuberters. Now, she didn't work for them.
Okay.
And it's also the state where Wayne Morris was a senator, Packwood. The current senator is from there. Very unusual, very well-educated, sophisticated, enlightened kinds of senators. And the state reflects that, and this is why she enjoys working there.
Is that N-E-W-B-E-R-G-E-R?
It's N-E-U-B-E-R-G-E-R.
Okay.
But I mentioned that by way of background. She didn't know the Neubergers. Mr. Neuberger died many years ago, and the wife moved to New York and married a Jewish doctor. So that was the end of the Neubergers in Oregon.
Were they both senators? Or just,
yes.
They were both senators.
She succeeded him after his death.
And they were Jewish.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Presently, you're working with the school strike, or the potential school strike.
Yes.
What would you tell us about that?
Well, with schools, there's been waves, and the public becomes interested only when they're inconvenienced, so that most bargaining goes on behind the scenes. For example, as of today, the headline concerns the possibility that the steelworkers will go on strike against USX, so that suddenly this hits the front page. But bargaining generally goes on outside of the public view, and there, it's a combination, especially in the public sector and the school sector, of everything from show business, economics, internal politics, timing, emotion, psychology, anything that you want to state. Because, as I said, we have people who are still amateurs as bargainers. When I go into a setting with private bargaining, as for example the USX bargaining, you would have the trouble telling the players without a scorecard as to who was on which side. They're very businesslike. They've been at this for 50-some years, and it's an almost routine sort of thing. For public employees, inclusive of school teachers, this is a comparatively new experience, and they play the role as they conceive it should be, whether it's a Perry Mason sort of thing or some other TV version of it. You have more personal invective. They feel that someone feels that the other side won't agree, that they are stupid and may say so, or are deliberately misstating and will say so in much more direct language than I just used. And as a result, the attitudes and fears are more important at the table than the subject matter itself. So that one has to try to keep the parties on track and try to introduce a certain amount of reason to have them keep in mind that their purpose there is to reach a settlement, and they don't need me to disagree. If they want to fight, I can just as well walk out, and they can have it with or without me. So that one has to do many things. One has to have a sense of timing. For example, this morning I was at a bargaining session that started at 7:30 in the morning because a couple of school board members wanted to have it then and then had to go on to work. School board members, by and large, work somewhere else. The parties moved along to a certain point, and I did almost nothing. Because here it is, July 31st, no one has to really make up their minds until the end of August, so that both sides can say no and nothing happens. However, if this were August 31st instead of July 31st, the parties would be under the gun and would have to make up their minds. At that point, I might bear down and either help one of the sides to rationalize accepting it, or to try to work out something that will help them to make up their minds. One has to realize that in school bargaining, as in almost all bargaining, the committee represents a diversity of interests. You have older employees who may be interested in pensions. Their mortgages are paid, their kids are raised, so wages may not be as important. You have younger people who are have to spend every dollar they get to pay for their mortgage, raising their kids, and so forth. The younger people might be very much interested in the maternity benefits they get. The older people are much more interested in a dental plan which provides for dentures, something that the younger people don't care about. So that you have these various special interests that are pushing that committee to come up with all these things which satisfy their particular needs. The contract just can't afford to have that. So that gradually within the committee itself and in the bargaining with management, they have to boil this thing down to something which, as I put it, will leave them equally unhappy, but which will result in a settlement. I have to convince the parties that no matter what they work out, there's going to be some people either on the board or the taxpayer group or the union group who are going to be very unhappy with the settlement. It is impossible to get a totally happy settlement on both sides. Now, this is a time-consuming matter. It may require a number of meetings. It will also require my judgment as to when to intervene and when not to intervene. If I intervene too early and stay too long and it hasn't worked out, I become part of the failure, so that I may get away from it and let the parties sweat it out. The other thing is to keep in mind that it's their agreement. I don't sign it. So that the presence of a mediator may sometimes result in their delegation of their responsibility to make up their minds, handing it over to a third party because they don't want to decide. It isn't an easy job for either side, and you work with them.
How has this affected the quality of education? Because I don't recall there being school strikes in number or at all 10 years or so ago, as there are now.
Well, the most dramatic school strike that really hit the front pages locally was that of, I think, 1967 or 68, when the Pittsburgh teachers went out. And this was before there was a law relating to the right to strike. There had been strikes, but not a great number, in New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, some of the other larger cities. We're still a little uncertain as to the relationship between strikes, collective bargaining, teacher quality, and education. It's very hard to measure because we have romantic notions of the dedicated school teacher who spent all kinds of hours for very little money teaching us when we were in school. The unionization of the teachers really didn't start until, on a widespread scale, until the 60s. Even in Pittsburgh, the Federation of Teachers had, from what I can recall, less than 100 members going into the mid-60s. But I tie it in with the civil rights movement, the women's movement. Keep in mind, all these movements started in the 60s when a great number of segments of our society felt, rightly or wrongly, that they were being treated as second-class citizens. You had the civil rights movement with blacks in the 50s and 60s, women, handicapped, all kinds of groups during the 60s said, hey, I'm being treated in an inferior fashion. And this included public employees, and one of the biggest components, of course, is the school teacher group. We'll know in time what unionization has done, together with market factors, it isn't all unions alone, has been to raise the income for teachers. So that I think the average for Pittsburgh teachers is now $40,000 or better. Now, 10 or 15 years ago, teachers might have been earning less than one half of that amount. The school district where I work this morning has an average salary of $30,000 or $32,000 and is talking about a $2,600 increase for just the 1 year. The increases that the school boards are giving are far above the average increases being given anywhere else to non-teachers in the public sector or to any private sector employees. In fact, many of them are just freezing wages. School teachers are coming in at 8, 9, 10%, you say. Now, this means that school teachers are reaching a point where they should be able to attract some pretty good people. Unfortunately, in education, until the returns come in on this more recent trend, the teachers have come from the lowest 25 percentile of the liberal arts grads, which is a depressing thought. However, it's been because wages, two factors were there. Wages were low, and the feminist movement has very much affected it. Before, women could only go into social work, teaching, or nursing in any great numbers, which traditionally were low paid. Now their opportunities are much greater elsewhere. And as a result, some of the very good people who were forced to go into teaching haven't gone there. They become attorneys, physicians, dentists, whatever. And so this has been a depressing factor. On the other hand, the higher wages, at least in theory, should be attracting better people, or attracting, having people already in get advanced degrees, do more graduate study, and so forth. I don't think the returns are in yet, and we may never be able to really measure it because demographics have resulted in such changes that it's very hard to compare, for example, Pittsburgh, where you have a very large, very poor white, black population in the school district, with the population that we may have known 30, 40 years ago. So that I don't know how you can really compare the standards.
That brings me to another question I wanted to ask. What do you think the influence of the women's lib movement has been on labor?
I think it has had two effects, both of which I think will grow. One has been that the labor movement has been more actively supportive of women's rights. It has always given lip service to it, but in practice has kind of, I would say, been almost hypocritical. For example, when I was put in charge of the Landrum-Griffin bill when it was first passed in 1959, I recall having to deal with a number of unions which had in their contract, the pottery workers, for example, East Liverpool, Ohio, a clause that said that no man would be laid off in the plant so long as any woman was employed there, in any job. There were also two-tiered rates, certain rates for women, certain rates for men, negotiated by the unions themselves. So that while unions have always on the surface said that they were in favor of fair play for women, it's only in recent years, buttressed by laws as well, equal opportunity laws, equal pay laws, and so forth, that the unions have been much more active. They have supported the Equal Rights Amendment unevenly in the more concentrated urban centers, they've been very active. In other centers, they may have been less active. So that's one of the effects. The other is that more and more women in the workforce have given them a greater voice, so that you see more and more union officials who are women. You find more women in the hierarchy of the AFL-CIO. They have yet to be recognized in any kind of proportion to their numbers. I find an interesting phenomenon in schools which still have a very large percentage of females, and that is that for whatever reason, they tend to elect a bargaining committee which is either solidly or predominantly male, even though they have the votes to do otherwise. So that some of the old roles still continue into their attitudes.
Do you have any predictions on daycare and maternity leave through labor?
I think that's a good question. I think much of it is going to depend upon the availability of the workforce. I maintain that there are very often two reasons why something happens, and one is the super, the seemingly obvious one, and one or more may be subtle factors. The daycare movement, at the instance of public support and or private, for example, Carnegie Mellon has a daycare center for their for children of employees, relates to employers of large numbers of female personnel. Now, whether they will have these centers when there is a plentiful supply of women who do not have children applying for jobs is something that we're going to have to look at over a period of time. So the employer might set something up of this sort at the request of his employees, either because he is a good altruistic employer or because that's the only way he's going to be able to get and keep help. And it may be a combination of the two. So the daycare center movement, which is developing quite rapidly as more and more women go into the workforce, is still in its formative stages. You have everything from the neighbor who keeps five kids around the house for a fee to centers. There's a shortage of centers, but the thing that organized labor has been pushing for have been centers paid for by the employer on or near the premises. I think that'll go along.
Okay, you know, we're cleaning up today, so I'm jumping around.
Right. Excuse me, before we go, can you tell me a little bit about this Landrum-Griffin bill?
Well, the Landrum-Griffin bill was passed in 1959, and it placed restrictions upon organized labor. It required bonding for those who handled funds. It had certain rules affecting election of union officers so that there could be the equivalent of one person, one vote. It protected the rights of the individual in his relationship to the union itself.
Now, how were you instrumental in helping?
Well, I was with the Federal Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division. This law was assigned to a newly created bureau, and I was detailed to set up the bureau offices here in Pittsburgh. And after I did so, I handed it over to the new personnel and went back to the Wage and Hour Division with which I had worked. It was there that I encountered a lot of these discriminatory practices. Then in the 60s, when they passed the Equal Pay Act, that law was assigned to my Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor, and it was there again where I ran into inequities. I won't give the name of a prominent shoe store, which we may patronize ourselves, but there, for example, I found that they paid women 1% on all their sales, even though they were selling both men's shoes and women's shoes, and paid men 2% on all their sales, although they sold the same mix of shoes. The explanation was that men were better salespersons. My answer was, if you gave both 2% and your premise was correct, the men would make more money anyway, you see. But there was an assumption. I found that the Pittsburgh department stores, this was in the 60s and I handled this, the Pittsburgh department stores paid women, female buyers, less than male buyers in fully comparable jobs, almost identical jobs. The explanation they gave was that women didn't have as many responsibilities as men. My answer to them was, this is a premise that just doesn't hold. If you want to set up a wage scale saying that everybody with dependents will be paid so-and-so, and everybody without dependents will be paid so-and-so, fine. Well, that immediately hit their executive training program, which had a large number of young men right out of college and other things. So the inconsistency was obvious. I had difficulty with unions sometimes. I can tell this because the plant is gone. Emerson Electric had a subsidiary in McKees Rocks where they had an assembly table and working at this table, doing identically the same job, putting components into an electrical assembly, were employees who were class one assemblers, who were all male, and class two assemblers, who were all female. The class one assemblers got 23 cents an hour more than the males. The company at my insistence raised the women 23 cents to equalize the wages, whereupon the union threatened to go on strike unless the men were raised another 23 to keep the differential. I met with the union officials who were very angry about all this, and I asked them about the history of this assembly table, which had 22 assemblers. I asked them how many males there were at that table 10 years ago, and they said it was 100% male. I said, how many now? And they said, two. All the rest were females. I said, well, don't you see what's happening? If I were the employer and I could get an assembler for 23 cents an hour or less, I'd hire a woman. I said, they're discriminating in favor of the women against you men because you set up the incentive for them to do so. At that point, the union backed down and accepted equal pay for equal work. So you sometimes had to use an argument which might be self-serving, a wallet kind of argument, but it got the job done.
Were you successful in the shoe store and department stores?
Oh yes, yes, they corrected, the department stores were beginning to correct it. They were more resistant because their wage structure was based upon a large number of low-paid female help. It's still that to a great degree. In recent years, the development of the suburban centers and with almost solidly part-time help has contributed to that. So that they most of them pay either the minimum wage or very little above it, recruiting housewives, students, and the like who don't expect to stay very long. The old days of the person who knew the stock and would serve you well is pretty well gone.
Okay. Maybe you can kind of list for us the positions and organizations that you've held.
Do you mean community organizations? Is that it?
Community, professionally related organizations?
Well, I see. Well, I have always held a union card. Even now, I have a membership card, the American Federation of Government Employees. It was a withdrawal because for my last several years I was management, so that I couldn't belong to one on an active basis. And I did organize the management group, all the directors of offices of the U.S. Department of Labor throughout the country, and I was the president and handled the bargaining for them, but it was really a management group that was dealing with, it was middle management dealing with top management. I belong to such organizations as the Industrial Relations Research Association, which is a self-evident group. I belong to the International Personnel Management Association, Pennsylvania Labor History Association, Society, organizations of that sort, professionally. On a personal level, I began to become interested in community affairs in the mid-1960s. I became a member of the board of the United Mental Health organization, primarily because I was issuing permits for sheltered workshops for the mentally retarded and emotionally disturbed. They had a program for the handling of the of those two groups, so I was interested in that. In the placing of handicapped people. In this respect, I had had some personal experience in dealing with organizations such as Vocational Rehabilitation Service, although I was never on their board. The From that, I became a member of the Board of Transitional Living Services, which is a halfway house organization for the mentally retarded and emotionally disturbed. I think I went off that board last year. I became a member of the board of the Jewish Family and Children's Service, and I was on that for about 12 years, rotated off because of the bylaws and for one term, and just went back on as of this year. I'm also a member of the Community Relations Committee of the UJF. Now, in those areas, I think my contribution to the board is in terms of the background that I've described to you. For example, there is sometimes a liaison with organized labor that is essential. Now, we do have a small Jewish labor committee here, which is almost totally inactive. Bess Topolsky, who used to work in the office of the Jewish Daily Forward and is still the local representative of the Workman's Circle, has some interest in activity. I had one particular instance that may be of interest to you in that connection. During the great boycott for Cesar Chavez, I don't know whether I told you this before or not, you can cut me off. They were picketing all the markets, A&P, Giant Eagle, and so forth, Kroger's, because they were selling non-union grapes. And they had leaflets that were passed out.